Listeners, hello. Welcome to another exciting episode of Wilco the Podcast, to say the least. Today, we have our first member of Wilco joining us, Mr. Nels Klein, who needs no introduction. Lance, how you doing? We just hung up with Nels.
I'm levitating. I think I'm 6 inches off the ground right now, Morgan. This is one we've been teasing this on the social media accounts. We said this is one for the books, and oh gosh, yeah, this one for the books.
It was a bucket list day for you, for sure.
It was a bucket list day. Let's go ahead and get into it, guys. Thanks so much for listening. We hope you enjoy. Hopefully this is half as fun for you guys as it was for us.
All right. Without further ado, here is our conversation with Nels Klein.
So, Nels, we have had the chance to see you multiple times, not only with Wilco, but back in 2014, you passed through Denver, and you were playing at the Razzle Dazz, which is no longer around, sadly. And then Matt and I actually got to see you at Ophelia's with Julian Lage in 2019.
Those are some lovely memories for me. Well, I just feel like a lucky dude. What can I say? It's nice to be able to go out and play my own music or play other people's music, and then also play the Wilco music, Jeff's music primarily, for a lot of people. You know, I don't really care how many people I play for, so it doesn't matter to me if they're on. Well, I often play for maybe 50 people, but that's usually in Brooklyn or city. But yep, it's fun. It's always fun to try to play.
I think you do more than try. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's what I was going to say, that anyone who has had the chance to watch you play, it's undeniable. We're seeing exceptional musicianship. So all that being said, today is a huge honor for us to chat with you. Thank you so much for being here.
It's my pleasure. And thank you guys for listening. You know, there's not a whole lot of point in doing this if somebody doesn't listen to it. You know, we just might as well stay home and then in our own little micro universe. It's much more fun to play out in different places. And also the audience, the listeners, whether you're at home listening, and I kind of don't always remember that happens, but you affect the music. You affect the way the music happens. It's an exchange.
Yeah.
So I'm appreciative of that.
You have spoken, I think, in other interviews about your intro to Wilco, how you joined the band. So we're not going to go over that again.
Story 4,000 times.
You don't want to tell it 4,001 times.
Yeah, exactly. We're curious though, just to jump into some questions. What, Nels, what was that like for you when you first joined Wilco, coming into a band that's already established? It's beloved by so many people. What was that like for you to carve out your own identity in the band? And then kind of a follow-up question would be, was there a defining moment where you knew being in Wilco was a good fit?
Oh, well, it's hard to say exactly how to answer that, the second part of that question, because there are many ways I could look at that. You know, I could say that having opened for Wilco a handful of times, the year prior to joining the band, I had some idea about their audience. You know, for example, I was playing with Carla Bozulich in her band opening for Wilco, and I was astonished that the Wilco audience was attentive and welcoming to the humble opening band, you know, which was certainly not always the case in my experience. I remember going out and the mid-90s with Mike Watt opening for Primus for an entire summer. And that was a much less welcoming audience that way, in spite of how lovely the Primus guys were to us and would come out and sit in with us and stuff. So I'd had plenty of quarters thrown at me and wet t-shirts and water bottles and stuff flying at me Not all the time, but my favorite was a bottle of dirt
Oh my
that
gosh.
landed in front of me, which I then smeared all over myself as I sang a Madonna.
You embraced it.
Yeah. So it was a welcoming environment even before I joined the band. But coming into it, I was, I guess, tiptoeing because, and as I've said before, one of the things about the time that Patrick and I joined was we were going to tour on A Ghost Is Born, which we weren't on, and which on which Jeff plays all this really fantastic guitar. So
right.
Question to him before I ever came to try playing with everybody was, why? You know, you're doing all this great guitar work now. And he just said, you know, well, we'll figure it out, you know, which is what we did. I wasn't, in spite of what I said about having opened for Wilco, quite as aware as I might have been of their, I guess I could say, the way they were venerated by their audience. So I was not paying so much attention to that aspect. That aspect hit me like a ton of bricks when I walked on stage the first time with them in DeKalb. We did two nights there. That place isn't there anymore. Stan Doty owned that club, Autos, and the ovation, the screaming ovation when we walked they scared the crap out of me. And I just thought to myself, like, wow, we haven't even played a note yet, you know. I knew that this was going to be an adjustment for the ardent Wilco fans, many of whom were still very attached to even an earlier iteration of the band before Leroy. I honestly wasn't very aware of any of that. So I would say that the first time, to answer the second part of your question, that the first time I felt sort of like it was going to be a good fit was after the very first rehearsal.
Nice.
Yeah, because I mean, I remember asking Jeff and John particularly, like, is it okay if I try some looping or is it okay if I do this? And they're like, hey man, just, you know, try some stuff, sure. And then after 3 hours, Jeff, you know, went home, and as he left, he said, sounds great. And I thought, okay, this is going to work, you know. So the second day, I felt more relaxed. You know, I mean, I wasn't having to play as many songs as we play now. So if he had said, here are 200 songs to learn or whatever, that would have been pretty tough. But there are maybe 60, you know, to start with. And for me, just trying to grasp some of the earlier material, not meaning technically, but in terms of my memory, was a challenge because I wasn't as aware of the early records. So, but I still felt welcomed and I felt happy that I could, I had some latitude. You know, I didn't know if it was going to be one of those situations where we like rehearse for 8 hours and I have to learn all these interior parts from the records and play them exactly. And it was quite the opposite. It was very relaxed. I had quite a bit of freedom and still do so.
Yeah. I guess a follow-up to that, Nels, would be, you know, did you find that you kind of had this freedom to make those older tracks kind of your own, or was it more like you need to learn these exactly how your predecessor played it? What was kind of the dynamic there?
I really wasn't told anything specifically about any parts except for maybe four or five. Like for example, and Shouldn't Be Ashamed, there's a part in the guitar solo that Jeff really wanted to hear. So I play it every time. And some of the little riffs on like Camera or Pot Kettle Black, you know, I learned those. But for the most part, especially like the AM stuff, and to a certain extent, the Being There material, I just did my take on it and everybody seemed to think it sounded good, you know. Mm-hmm.
That's awesome. Yeah. So, and kind of going off of that, you know, with your side projects, Nels, you bring a pretty different approach, I would say, than to the Wilco songs. So we're curious, how do you approach contributing to a Wilco song? Like, does Jeff typically know the sound or maybe the style he's after, or do you kind of suggest a certain direction and experiment with different textures and guitars? Is it kind of more of like a experimentation, like a collaborative experimentation, or is it more like Jeff kind of calling the shots?
It can be either one, honestly. I know that sounds like a kind of mealy mouth response, but sometimes it can be both at the same time on the same song. So, for example, Jeff quite often will want me to just try things, and I have a lot of latitude when I'm doing that. But quite often, it leads to him streamlining or suggesting things that he may have already been thinking about before I started messing around, you know, and then he gets his arrangement, you know, or he gets the approach from me that he was looking for. And I don't know to what extent what I'm playing fires that in his imagination, or whether he had some idea ahead of time that he was hoping I would veer towards, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And certain records had a lot more general group input than others, because some of the, like the around the Star Wars and Schmilko era, they're more layered, you know, which is had a lot to do with just circumstances, the circumstances of people having moved out of Chicago at that point, Jeff going through stuff in his personal life and needing that time to just try every kind of idea he could possibly try when he wasn't driving back and forth in his car around Chicago. And as such, those still had the same kind of experimentation that I was describing earlier, but it wasn't all with all of us playing together at the same time, which were not very often anyway, as opposed to Sky Blue Sky or even The Whole Love, which was, there's a lot of, or certainly Cruel Country, where the band's just, you know, jamming out together a lot. And I think this methodology of the Star Wars, well, actually, when I listen to Star Wars now, there's a lot more group playing on it than I remembered. But Ode to Joy is another kind of layered one. And a lot of sonic experimentation went on in my, for my end of it, with Ode to Joy. And certain tracks, I don't think I contribute really much of anything, because it didn't need anything, you know. One of my favorite Wilco songs is Quiet Amplifier.
I wish you were, was mine. I wish you were, was mine.
But that's a song that we could not figure out how to do live, because essentially Jeff's doing all this really cool electric guitar stuff, yet he needs to be playing acoustic guitar. This has happened on quite a few songs where I basically have to learn his electric guitar parts, which are very singular. And a fun challenge, honestly. At times, it's very challenging because he has a very kind of noticeable style, in my opinion. And I just love the way he plays certain things, but it's not really the way I play, right? But how do you playing acoustic guitar to get the song to sound the way he wants it to sound? And that's sort of his version, the dilemma for him that I find when I've recorded lap steel on a song and say 12 string or some kind of other guitar part. So now live I'm playing, you know, a lot of slide and then playing guitar and trying to get lap steel sounds on the guitar. And so there's little bits of, I guess, little trouble that comes up here and there trying to get that, because we're very, I think, you know, assiduous about our live sound and trying to get all the tones just right and the arrangements just right. So Quiet Amplifier was impossible. I mean, there's just something about the way Jeff played the guitar parts on that and the atmosphere that it has. I think all I do is sustain feedback through that song. And it just wasn't, I mean, I just would love to play that song and get it to sound like that live, but apparently it just is kind of an impossibility. So every once in a while we have these kinds of challenges to reproduce or to try to reproduce something that can't really be reproduced. Instead, it's saying a lot because we're pretty good at it, I think, overall.
I think so, yes. Too.
We've got our fingers crossed that maybe we'll get to hear that solid sound with the deep cuts.
So. Well, I would hope so, but I'm telling you, man, I don't know that it's doable. I mean, okay. I think that I'm not going to speak for Jeff or anybody else, but I have a feeling that we're all going to, if I suggest it, we're all going to look at each other and go like, nah, it's impossible. That one's impossible.
I wish you were this man.
I'm glad we have a recording of that. That is a fantastic song and recording.
Yeah, yeah. I just love listening to it. It really, really trips me out in the best way.
Yeah.
Almost like I wasn't in the band. I can listen to it as though it's some band I really dig. You know?
So Nels, you have several songwriting credits across the Wilco catalog. I'm probably missing some, but You Are My Face and You Satellite are a couple examples of that. We're curious what designates a songwriting credit versus just normal collaboration? No answer to that?
You Are My Face is a really interesting story. And I didn't really think about it as a co-write at the time. Jeff had asked us to, and this is a long time ago now, you have to imagine that Patrick and I joined 20 years ago. So this is maybe 18 years ago. He was asking us to just demo up ideas, any ideas we had. And I did this thing that was kind of raga-like in 5/8. I think it was like dun 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 dun, some little thing, and droned out, and then the chord progression on the "I had no idea how this happened," that whole part. So I wrote those chords, but that was a different. I think I came up with that in the loft when we were all working. So Jeff had that whole droning, you know, all the vocal parts that are with John and the harmony parts. And he took that 5/8 thing, made it into 4/4, not surprised there, halftime, completely reharmonized the melody with those chords that you hear, and changed one note on the repeat. And it became this whole other thing, just because it started with a melody of mine and then has those sort of central, middle of the tune chords. I got a co-write, but I wasn't even thinking about it. You know, You Satellite's really just kind of like a streamlined jam. I don't know that I wrote any coherent music on that, but there you have it.
Are there any other songwriting credits that we're overlooking here that you
The other stuff is group stuff. Like if you look at the songwriting credits on Sky Blue Sky, there's like, it'll say like Jeff Tweedy, blah, blah, and basically the entire band. Mm-hmm. And that was how that record, a lot of that record was conceived. The Whole Love, Patrick had a lot to do with that record. Mm-hmm. And then since those days, I mean, Jeff just, you know, he writes about 40 songs a week. So you have to just keep up with that, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, he always has at least 50 songs, it seems like, just looking for a home, you know, and that's ramped up over the last several years. It's really quite astonishing.
Yeah.
I got a text from one of our listeners who lives in Denver, and he was saying yesterday to me, he said, "Man, whenever Jeff is gone, Spencer or Sammy, they're going to have their work cut out for him, like releasing a lot of these backtracks that we've never heard."
There's a lot of stuff.
Wow.
I don't even know how much, honestly, because I know that you just worked on a new Tweedy record early this year. I don't think it's done. I actually haven't checked in on that, but the man's prolific.
Yeah, seriously. Nels, I'm just curious with Quiet Amplifier, are there any other songs where you guys as a band say, let's not even touch that, performing that live?
Oh, there! I'm sure there's quite a few. I know we've tried certain things. My memory is going to fail me now. It's just a lot of songs. I think there are a lot of material from "Ode to Joy," for example, which you know, it's really more about not trying them and thinking they're not working, as some of them are just too slow and dark for a exciting rock recital. you know, Jeff slaves over a hot set list, as I like to say, nightly when we're on tour. Every once in a while, he'll ask somebody in the band to start a set list or do a set list, and then he'll edit it or change it slightly. But basically, the architecture is kind of set that we're going to end rocking out. You know, we're not going to necessarily throw in this massive curveball towards the end of the show and then and then play, you know, like a 10 minute version of Radio Cure just to see if people can handle it, you know?
Yeah.
But I can't think of too many, some of the Ode to Joy material that was very hard to reproduce. We did it, you know, I feel like we did slightly different, sonic renditions of that material, but some of it was pretty challenging. Quiet Amplifier is the only one that sticks out in my head as the impossible, but also because I'm so in love with it, but that I want it to happen. You know, some of the other ones, they are slow and dark and I love them, but I understand why we're not playing them nightly, you know?
Sure. Mm-hmm. Sure. Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Continuing the theme of live performance, apparently, and you might can speak to this, but apparently you've played Impossible Germany over 887 times, according to one of those set list stats.
See, this is now the statisticians are ruling us.
Exactly.
I don't think about this. I do think about it as the blessing and the burden of my life, you know, but
yeah.
I mean, no one saw this coming, I'm sure, but it, you know, Jeff has it on the set list almost every night, and it's gotten longer the last year or two, not intentionally, but we got into this drone thing that Jeff and I like to do, and the guys like to sort of like just chill more behind me, and it gives me a lot of space. But that's a lot of times.
That's a lot. And I've noticed that it's gotten longer, and I love that because it's so organic, and you can tell. It's fun to see you play different venues where you can see like, oh, it kind of takes this shape this night, and then it kind of goes that way another night. Even though you have that structure, it's fun to see you experiment.
Well, it's fun to try, you know, it's like some nights it just doesn't exactly happen. You know, I mean, I feel like I'm just sort of struggling and then Glenn will say, that was one of my favorite ones. Or so I just never know, you know, it's fun to try. It's an incredible, just a weird anomaly, just in my life, but it seems like just on the musical landscape to have this kind of weirdly epic guitar song at a time when they don't really exist in culture all that much, you know, even in metal where there's a lot of guitar features, usually the solos are extremely compact, you know. Mm-hmm. A lot of brisk and truncated finger wiggling until the next big moment, unless it's like stoner rock or something, and then it's not, think of it as guitar solo music as much as just sort of sonic sludge, like the right, which I love, you know. I'm just saying it's not like it's tightly arranged, you know, those three guitars. I mean, I'm still, when I listen to the way we arranged those three guitars, I'm still very pleased with the way it's voiced, and people seem to really still love it, so here we go.
Curious, I mean, after 800 times, like, what, walk us through, like, in your mind, what's going on in your head when you're here? Okay, here's the Nels Klein solo.
Well, I don't know how to describe that. You know, I have to start it pretty much the same way. I mean, so you know, I've told the story of the recording this song before, but it's kind of worth reiterating because the way I start and end the solo is basically what I played on the Sky Blue Sky album. But what that is what I played on the demo of the song after I came up with the idea to have a long instrumental coda to the song, which wasn't supposed to have a guitar solo at all. It was all supposed to be tightly arranged guitar parts that never changed.
Wow.
And so not to go too far into that, Jeff asked me after falling in love with the way I played on the demo to kind of replay the solo from the demo. So I had to relearn my improvised solo. My point is that I think that people respond in the same way that he did, having heard what I played on that demo to the guitar in a way that I was completely unaware of. And I, when we went to record the Sky Blue Sky version for real, and I was completely improvising the solo, that's what I would have done every night, is started completely differently and whatever. I don't think the song would have exactly the same trajectory. Certainly the written part and the guitar parts and all that stuff would still be beautiful, but this kind of ritual now of having the big guitar solo at the end, I don't think it would feel the same way without those melodies that Jeff singled out that he enjoyed. And that says something about his musical acumen, or his just something about his taste and what resonates with him. And it tends to resonate with his audience. So, and I'm generally oblivious to all that. So I think that that is something that I ponder every time I attack it.
Yeah.
Of a solo, and I just think, okay, here it goes. And I'm always slightly nervous because I still every once in a while screw up, but it's, I don't want to make a grotesque clam or a clunk or something like that, because I know it's this kind of moment for everybody, not just for me and the band. So that's what that feels like, if that means anything.
Absolutely. You know?
Definitely become one of those moments that as a fan we look forward to, like, here comes the Nels Klein Impossible Germany guitar solo. And actually I'm holding up for our listeners, this is the Impossible Germany guitar solo hat from Solid Sound.
Oh, I never even seen that before.
Oh, you haven't seen this? Yeah, this was a Solid Sound purchase in 2022.
Oh my god, I never see.
I think Oxford Pennant made that.
Yeah,
they
Oxford
had
Pennant. Yeah,
different designs, but Morgan went with the wise choice.
It's,
there.
It's iconic, you know.
Well, I didn't know, but I guess I don't know what the right word is, but I kind of think in the back of my mind very often in the course of a tour, like is everyone? I'm asking myself, is everyone sick of this by now? And I think we do maybe have to at some point see if we can give it a rest, for the audience's sake, not for mine. You know, and I'm always happy to try, but whoa!
please don't give it a rest.
I don't think anyone's sick of it yet. Yeah.
Oh my god!
It's got some more years on it.
All right. I don't follow any chatter out there in the internet's world, so I'm not privy to people's opinions, negative or positive, to be honest. So I'm just going to take you guys' word for it.
Please. I've heard Jeff say that Impossible Germany and Jesus, Etc., they complete a circuit for the audience. And I would say, I feel seen by that. I'm expecting to hear those songs, and I would feel really bummed to miss
them. Sometimes we don't play them. It's pretty rare. Well, we do those no repeat things.
Right.
And those are fun. I love playing, I don't know, like 100 songs or whatever. It's really fun.
Yeah. We were at the Riviera. I guess that was like over a year ago now, Lance, wasn't it?
Yeah.
March 23. Yeah. And
third night.
So we got the Impossible Germany set.
I was going to say, I seem to recall that was Impossible Germany on the third.
Yeah.
We were happy. Nels, you said you can feel nervous with that. You don't want to make a mistake. We're curious, how often do you feel nervous? Are there any solos where you do feel nervous going into?
I don't feel super nervous playing on the Wilco stage, to be honest. It's kind of just like I just get into the whole atmosphere of it, and the and I mean, I still like sound checks, you know. I mean, I just as soon as the sound cranks up, I'm a happy guy. But I get really, really nervous playing other people's music in the so-called jazz world, or my own music, or whatever, especially in a recording studio situation. I'm still a complete wreck. You know, it's something about, you know, in terms of my own recordings, primarily what we're doing is capturing performances. And the idea of that's pretty nerve-wracking, and it hasn't gotten easier as I've gotten older. I think it's gotten actually harder. And I just think it's because I'm putting myself under the microscope unnecessarily, but I can't seem to stop doing it. So I'm working on that. You know, I'm not going to start taking beta blockers, or you know, or maybe I should go into therapy or something. But
Well, Lance is a therapist, so you
yeah,
need
I
a
can.
wow. Okay. So that's when I get nervous. And definitely when it comes to if I play somebody's music that's really difficult, which I don't do that often at this point. I did it quite a lot more in my earlier years. And I come up and I'm coming up on a really difficult passage. I can tell you that I'm the choke king. I will totally blow it every time, you know, when any kind of pressure. A lot of the amazing virtuosi that I get to play with thrive on that. You know, they thrive on that energy, and they thrive on that kind of risk, I guess, if you want to look at it that way. And I just find it completely debilitating.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, that's surprising to hear, as like seeing you perform with and without Wilco. I mean, you always just seem so at ease and in your element.
Yeah, but you guys know what's going on in my head. What I'm hearing, what I want to play is sometimes so far from what I end up playing, you know. So maybe it's a good thing, because I have a million notes buzzing around in my head in most situations. Certainly not when I'm playing, say, Radio Cure or something. But I mean, when I'm improvising, particularly playing succinct solos with a lot of space and restraint is very difficult for me.
Nels, we're curious, just kind of opening the door to, maybe dusting off some memories here. Are there any favorite stories that you have with Wilco, maybe either on tour or in the studio? Any memories that like really stick out in your mind that are kind of indicative to the relationship you have with the other band members?
Oh my God. I mean, this is my mind goes blank, and I have a feeling that this was coming too, and I still can never come up with anything. You know, the things that stand out in my mind are, to be honest, are usually when we have some kind of musical liaison, you know, whether a guest or somebody in the audience that we all revere, and the way everybody sort of as a band responds to that, and the way that feels, you know, generally it's such a warm feeling, and it's an exciting and rarely disappointing. And so I remember doing like, well, actually, I hate award shows. I hate contests in terms of art and so-called creativity and all that. But the Austin City Limits Hall of Fame show that and being inducted into the Austin City Limits Hall of Fame experience was incredible for me. It was incredible what Roseanne Cash said about Wilco. It made me like cry. It was so beautiful and so highly considered. And Terry Allen being there and playing one Sunday morning, and you know, being there, and you know, and Lucinda and you know, Alejandro being inducted as well, but also just playing with some of those guys and just being there, that really felt like something. And I know that it had to be super major for Jeff, and he takes all this stuff sort of like he's very low key about it. But that was just a really warm memory for me. And it's not like stories like when we were in Europe many years ago, and with our crew and band all on one bus, and a bunch of people got food poisoning, and it was
Oh gosh.
Sounds
like
awful.
it was Voyage of the Damned. It was
Oh man.
So those are the kind of road stories that he likes.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
And it was, I didn't get sick because I didn't eat what I think was the lentil soup is what I think people.
Oh man, nothing safe.
Yeah. French truck stops. So yeah, it was horrible. I mean, but then, you know, when you have people, you know, come in and sit in with the band, like Bill Frisell, I brought in some people like Bill and Derek Trucks, and then Alan Sparhawk a few times has played with us, and beautiful, and having Courtney Marie Andrews and just like amazing people doing amazing things, sitting in with the band and just being on tour with us. Those are somehow some of the things that stand out more than oh yeah, this audience was so great, or oh, we really crushed it tonight, or anything like that. You know, we're doing this now with the same six guys for 20 years, and there's a reason that I think we can do that. And it's not because, oh, we're all just all hanging in there to make a living. It's because we really like it, mm-hmm. and we like each other. So that's miraculous. And I couldn't do it if it wasn't this kind of hospitable, friendly, warm. And yeah, every once in a while we have our challenges because we all have egos and we all have ideas, you know, but it's not debilitating. And it's generally nourishing, I think.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, I'm not in a famous band, but I that seems like a very rare situation to find yourself in.
It's extremely rare. I mean, I actually am kind of addicted to reading musician memoirs. There are quite a few out there these days, especially the last few years. And man, the levels of dysfunction, which we all kind of knew about and, you know, we read about in maybe magazines or something in an interview. But even reading all these memoirs, I just think like, man, this situation is very, very unique. And it's pretty awesome, man.
Mm.
All right. So now for the gearheads out there, and I'm a guitar player myself, nowhere near your level, but I'm just curious how you go about choosing a guitar for any certain Wilco song. And I think if I'm not mistaken, you kind of bend toward Fender, the jazz master. But yeah, just jazz curious master. About how you pick your instruments.
Okay. Well, the jazz master was my main guitar prior to joining the band. And before that, that's the one you see me play nightly, unless there's something, you know, wrong with it, in which case I have to play backup. But that's the one I bought from Mike Watt in 1995 that he had, and that how I ended up with it is a long story. But I didn't realize at the time, because my main guitar at the time had been a Fender Jaguar.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't even know the difference. I mean, I bought the Jaguar because I was completely enchanted with the sounds that Thurston Moore and Lee Rinaldo and Sonic Youth were making.
Mm-hmm.
I was, you know, always really into Tom Verlaine and his jazz sound, from even though he didn't play a jazz master the last like 25 years of his life, but I didn't really even know the difference between all these guitars, and I don't know that much about guitars as opposed to somebody like Mr. Tweedy, who's not only owns an incredible number of guitars but also really knows about them.
Uh-huh.
This is actually something really fun in the band. For me, is that it's kind of this innocent obsession, you know, to find the right sound or find the right, I don't know. It's really extremely over the top in the case of recording in the Wilco loft, where there's so many guitars.
Mm-hmm.
But in my case, I tend to gravitate towards one kind of tone that I associate with the different things I can do with my jazz master, which is quite a number of tones. It's also very comfortable to play. It has strings behind the bridge, which I generally require. It has a tremolo arm on it, which I like. And I can do the wiggle, or I can do weird noises or powerful screams or something, and also still get beautiful, clean tone. But sometimes I need more twang, you know, in the case of a sort of country influence song. You know, on Cruel Country, it's Patrick doing almost all that stuff. He's doing E Bender Telly, sounding, you know, really amazing. But when I have to go for that sound, I tend to gravitate towards lipstick case pickup guitars like Silvertone Dan Electro, or particularly the sort of later and well-made version, the Jerry Jones guitars from when he was making such guitars. And also with a lighter string gauge so I can bend more notes, because I don't do a whole lot of note bending in my own music. And with Wilco, it's here and there. Like I play maybe like a straight on rock approach on Shouldn't Be Ashamed or something like that, on Monday or something. But I'm playing, you know, like 12s on my guitar, so that they're not, it's not that easy to bend a 12 set on a Jazzmaster, because they already also have extra sort of string tension compared to some guitars, longer length. So if I want to bend more notes and I want some twang, some spank, if you will, I'll go for a set of the 11s and these lipstick case pickups generally. This said, the other consideration is hum, like 60 cycle hum. And Jazzmasters, quite famously, I think, or infamously, hum like crazy. They're single coil pickups that are extremely noisy. And the same would be true, but maybe to a slightly lesser extent, of any single coil pickup, like a P90, you know, or what's on Strats or Tellys or anything like that. So sometimes I choose things based on hum canceling, in which case the tone can be a little bit more muted than I'm used to, or it can be just this classic sound. Like Jeff, you know, many years ago gave me this chambered gold top Les Paul that I play a random name generator or things. And it's just when I play that, and it's got 11s on it, and if I play that all overdriven, it's like I'm a completely different person. I feel like suddenly I'm like Warren Haynes or something, and I know exactly what to play in a weird way, but it doesn't sound like me necessarily, right? But that speaks to your question, which is that it then sounds the way I think that sound should sound, you know, me. And I, when people tell me that I have a style, I kind of just still don't believe it, because I feel like I just change what I'm doing to try to fit the song, you know, and fit the sonic atmosphere of that song, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But also Jeff will suggest stuff when we were recording in the loft. He'll, you know, he has all kinds of ideas about what guitars might work. If once he hears me trying a certain idea, he quite often might say like, hey, why don't you try it on this guitar? And he'll pull out some big jazz box with flat wound strings on it. And I'll do that. Why not? You know?
So but, when you're recording at the loft, it's like, you're not necessarily bringing your own instruments. It's like the loft has every guitar you could imagine. And it's kind of like pick your weapon.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to gather my stuff around me, and then I rarely depart from that. But I mean, that'll be like a, you know, my 12 string, and a Jaguar is good for also sort of like needly, thin, spanky tones, not just a lipstick case guitar, but I'll have maybe a silver tone sitting there, and I might pull out the Les Paul or, you know, that stuff's all ready to go. But yeah, then you never know. Jeff might pull out some Tysco or some Czech, you know, really cheapo Czech guitar from the 70s and say, like, this has really good sounds behind the bridge. Or he'll say, you know, and anyway, so that's a possibility for sure.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
I'm having a thought of the Nels Klein sound. I feel like the outro to Everlasting Everything just sounds... I'm like, oh, that's undeniably you.
Oh, that's got the wiggle, you know?
Yeah, it's got the wiggle.
I don't know when I started doing that, and it was certainly not... a sound I used in my early playing, but it's definitely influenced by Tom Verlaine, who doesn't use the bar to do it. He did it with his hand. His hand vibrato was very fast. Mine used to be fast when I was a teenager. And everybody slowed down. It was all Eric Clapton's fault and Mick Ronson, you know, like this really slow vibrato, and became very unfashionable to play with fast vibrato. But I brought it back because of Tom and also John Cipollina, who used the bar on his SG in Quicksilver Messenger Service. And I realized that there was a moment when I'm sure the first time I did, I was probably in my mind, I was like paying homage, or shall we say imitating or aping what Tom Verlaine does at the end of the guitar solo on the song Marquee Moon. But also at that time when I heard that record, reminded me of John Cipollina and how much I love his playing, particularly on the first two Quicksilver records. And I did it, and it kind of, I guess, feels like something to me. It feels like a voice. And that sort of idea became amplified for me when a friend of ours, who at the time, she's French, and she was actually in Paris when we were playing there, said to me after the show that there were certain things I was doing on the guitar that reminded her of Edith Piaf. And then I thought about, oh, it's the wiggle. It's the fast vibrato. And it was also a vocal approach that was very ubiquitous in the 20s and 30s, and also sort of died out after the 50s or after the 40s maybe, and became a different sound. And so I kind of just wanted, and also it makes me think of Django Reinhardt's vibrato, very quick. And I like it. So I used it on the end of Everlasting Everything. And then I loop the stuff and just do the, you know, echo looping that I now just can't stop doing.
Yeah, fantastic. Morgan, do you want to bump into lightning round?
Lightning round?
Lightning round.
Yeah, there's just four quick questions here, and you can make them your answers as long as you want, but we call it the lightning round. So the first question, Nels, is in honor of the Solid Sound announcement that Wilco will be playing a Deep Cuts set list this year. We're curious, what would be your favorite Wilco deep cut song?
Well, we have the band kind of has a favorite one that we always mention as the deep cut that could be a challenge. In my case, it's a challenge because I have to play two guitars during the song, which is Deeper Down.
Oh, yes. I've been thinking about that song.
Yeah, which I love playing, but I have to play my shorty 12 string, my Jerry Jones up here like Steve Howe. But I'm sitting down and have a lap steel in my lap, and then I get up to get an AB box to play the lap steel part, and then to play the little like harpsichordy,
mm-hmm.
and go back to the lap steel. So it's memorable and charming. It's not overly complicated. It's just kind of orchestral.
What a unique Wilco song. I hear that and I'm like, that doesn't sound like any other Wilco song I've heard.
Yeah, I don't even remember how that one came about, but you know, Jeff wrote it and we played it. That's all I can remember.
Yeah. You guys played that for, was it Craig Ferguson? Or
jeez, I don't know.
I'm trying to remember if I
think we did One Wing at least on Craig Ferguson. And that's I was like playing that one.
Yeah.
Sunloath might be another deep cut, but it's only minutes long. So it's so live, it sort of happens and then it's gone, you know, and that can be a head scratcher for the audience. Like, what was that one?
Yeah.
A song that kind of comes up as we talk about Wilco a lot is Common Sense.
And yes.
I think Jeff makes a joke about that being one of the least liked Wilco songs, but it sounds like it'd be a tough song to play live.
Yeah,
I wonder, so out I there.
Yeah, I think you're right about now. I'm going to be thinking about this. I think I was going to say that we always have one that is a deep cut that we used to play a lot, but I'm going to leave that one because then there's going to be demand to play it, and Jeff doesn't want to play it, so I'm just going to.
Got it.
All right.
Okay.
Are you guys already talking about what songs are going to be on that set list for Solid Sound?
We haven't for a while. We talked about it when we were all on tour together, but we haven't talked about it moving forward too much. I mean, they would all be just emails and stuff. So,
got it.
So I think that'll start pretty soon.
Okay. Next question is, what's your favorite Wilco song to perform?
I don't have a favorite. I'm sorry. I just don't. I remember this question now, and I remember thinking, this is impossible. I don't think that way, you know, that I don't even have a favorite Wilco album, you know. So, you know, there are certain songs that are more fun to play than others, but sometimes my feeling about playing the song has to do with how I feel about the way it feels to play rather than the content specifically of the song. Like, for example, playing One Wing always feels amazing because it's so dynamic and it rocks at the end, and I like the harmonic content of it, the whole mood of it. So that's a favorite. But I also used to love playing, you know, when we do One Sunday Morning, and I just basically play the same thing over and over for 12 minutes, the same riff, and then, you know what I mean? It's incredibly enjoyable, you know, just like playing, for example, we did at the end of the Cruel Country kind of main American run of that, we ended in Chicago playing three shows at the Country Western Bar there, Carol's Pub. And we play cover songs as well, like country cover songs, and playing, Jeff loves to play this song, She's My Rock. And when just playing that was incredibly fun because the song is, it's so kind of odd and entertaining, but also super straightforward. And it's a little amusing. And so playing cover songs like that is, it's always a fun thing to do because it's not quite so, I guess, serious or reverent, even though, I mean, we have songs that aren't super serious or that just rock out, but those are really fun to play because they're, for me, especially anyway, because I didn't grow up playing in bar bands and playing in a million cover bands. So it's always a fun challenge, and feels a little like sort of like a big exhale, like you just kind of relax and have fun.
Love that.
Nels, what do you think the most underrated Wilco album is?
I don't know how people perceive the albums, you know, I really don't. I'm gonna go with Glenn on this, and I think he and I are united that Ode to Joy is is a record that may sort of end up standing out. But I don't read the reviews and I don't read any of the chatter about anything. I feel like maybe it was just because of how it was rolled out or publicity or something that Cruel Country is, I think it's just an amazing record. And so I don't know if it's underrated or not. I think it's an amazing achievement. It was really fun to make. And I think the songs are amazing.
Yes.
Just my opinion.
Love that. Great shout out. We hear, as we ask Mark Greenberg and Ushwin that question, I think they both answered Ode to Joy. So there seems to be a consensus there that it was overlooked.
My favorite tracks on that are really dark and I mean, it's a murky kind of record. And of course, anyway, I could go on, but I like it.
We do too.
Quiet Amplifier.
That's right. That's right. All right, Nels, last question for you. What would be your desert island disc? You're stuck. You got that one album with you.
Possibly. Well, it's actually a reissue of two albums. And it's by the Jimmy Giuffre Three. And it's called 1961 on the ECM label.
I'll admit I'm unfamiliar with that, but same. I'll have to go check it out.
Yeah.
It's clarinet, piano, and acoustic bass. You know, I mean, I could think of a billion other records, but something about, I used to always travel with this along with some, you know, Ravel piano music, recordings and, Satie and things like that. So I think it has to do with the idea that it's, sort of concomitantly, intriguing, inspiring. It's kind of chills me out, but at the same time, it piques my interest. Mm-hmm. It's a timeless kind of improvisatory, sort of free but controlled, composed experience, which you could say about a lot of Jimmy Giuffre stuff, or that I could go completely the other direction. And you know, when I think about favorite records, I don't know if I want to, or if I want or need to hear them on my desert island. Like I've heard Axis Bold as Love 4 billion times, and I would possibly at some point on my desert island really want to hear it, but I can definitely play it in my head.
It's a classic. Yeah,
absolutely. Nels, I gotta as we start to wrap up here, I got to show you a picture that I had taken at Solid Sound.
So we should describe to the listeners. This is Lance standing in front of Nels, and he's wearing a Star Wars t-shirt, and Nels kind of has his arms stretched out toward Lance.
And I've recently wondered, Nels, if you were paying homage to Star Wars with that pose, or if that was just
no.
But I
remember this. Yeah, because there's this gulf, you know. They put up these barriers, and then you're standing on stage.
Yeah.
And people want to talk to you at the same time. I have to hurry my ass off stage, and at least I have help. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That was on that parking lot stage that I always end up playing.
The hottest stage.
Oh my God. Well, hot for the audience. It's brutal.
Yeah. But,
you know, that's a beautiful combination. Sun, heat, and asphalt.
Gotta love it. Well, Nels, we just are so grateful for today. When I first started listening to Wilco, this was about 2008. So you had already joined the band. And Wilco's my favorite band ever. I just eat you guys up. And for me, having come to the band after you had already joined, I'd say your presence is easily as significant to me as Jeff Tweedy in the band or John Sturratt or any of them. And I would honestly say it was largely through your contributions to Wilco, to the Wilco sound, that made it become my favorite band.
You're embarrassing me now.
We love all that you brought. And so I just want to say today has been it's huge for me. It's a bucket list. I am honored to be able to chat with you today. And I say that on behalf of Morgan too.
Me too, Nels.
You guys are too sweet. And will I be seeing you at Solid Sound?
Then? We will be there.
We'll be there this year. Yeah.
I'm always running around. So please buttonhole me and say hello. I'm trying not to be quite as busy this time as I was last time.
Yeah. Maybe we can get a closer picture with you this time.
The two of us. That's what I'm getting at. That's
exactly. Yeah. Without the barrier. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Nels, thank you again so much for doing this. And we'll see you at Salt Sound.
You will. All right. Much love.
Thanks Take so care. Much. Have a good day.
Dude, I got to get a vacuum cleaner.
Good luck.
Wilco the Podcast is produced by Lance Hill and Matt Morgan. Editorial and theme music by Matt Morgan. You can find us on Instagram at Wilco the Podcast or shoot us an email at wilcothepodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.